KQED.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Humanity's first mission to a star began early yesterday morning when NASA launched the Parker Solar Probe from Cape Canaveral, Florida. The spacecraft will circle Venus seven times before heading to the sun's corona, where it will gather data on solar flares and other phenomena. Astronomy professor Andrew Fracknoy joins us this segment to discuss NASA's journey to the sun and other celestial news, including newly discovered moons around Jupiter and an underground lake on Mars. And we want to hear from you, from last night's meteor showers to the World Science Fiction Convention, which is coming to San Jose this week. What cosmic matters are on your mind? And what questions do you have? Join us at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. And I remind you, you can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going right to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And welcome, Andy Fracknoy.
Well, nice to be back with you.
Good to have you back. We carved out a special half hour to talk about all these matters in the sky and stellar and beyond. If people were up late enough last night, they could have seen some of these 70 meteors per hour, I think they were clocking at. Is there more to come?
Well, every year at this time, we go through a swarm of cosmic garbage left over by a dirty comet.
It's literally what it is.
Literally, cosmic garbage left over by a comet that's shedding some of its dirt. And then as we go around the sun, when we encounter that swarm of dirt, we get shooting stars or a meteor shower.
And are there more coming?
Yes. So there are regular meteor showers.
Where to be seen and all that?
The meteor shower that's best is this one, the Perseid meteor shower. But we also have good ones in December. We have sometimes in the spring. Some of these showers vary depending on how close the comet is to the dirt that it left behind. So people can Google meteor showers, and there are nice lists of them on the web.
Well, I said we would talk about a number of other things, and I want to go into a number of other things with you. Let's start off by talking about this solar probe, because, I mean, Icarus should have learned or taught us some things before. But Jimi Hendrix said, you know, go and kiss the sun and all that. This is pretty fascinating. First of all, talk about it, but also, what do they hope will come out of this? What are we going to discover? What do we want to discover?
Well, yeah, this is one of the most exciting things NASA has ever tried. And it's really wonderful that it got off on Sunday to a good start. The sun, which kind of looks steady and reliable in the sky, is actually, when you get close to it, quite variable. The surface of the sun is a seething hot mess of not just gas, but magnetic fields, strong, strong magnetism in the sun, which roils the solar outside. And so there is a wind coming from the sun, a regular blowing out of particles, which go by the Earth at 1,000,000 miles per hour. And there's also explosions on the sun when the magnetism is suddenly let go. And so there's a huge stream of particles. These are called coronal mass ejections. And if they're big enough, they can actually interfere with communications on Earth, with the power grid. So we want to monitor and understand the sun better. And this Parker Solar Probe is designed to do that by actually, as you say, kissing the sun for the first time, going into the atmosphere of the sun, which is an outrageous idea if you think about it. We're going to get within 3.8 million miles of the sun, which is well within its outermost layers. And the temperature that it's going to encounter, I looked this up, is 2,500 degrees Fahrenheit.
Well, as long as you're giving out numbers and you're talking about 1,000,000 miles an hour, this is going to travel at 430,000 miles per hour, which means you could go to Philly and D.C. in a second.
Yeah.
One second.
Absolutely. So when you go this close to the sun, you want to go pretty fast.
And so wear all your suntan lotion, of course.
There you go. And it has special solar resistant coating always on the side that's going to be facing the sun. And what they're going to try to do is to go by Venus, rob Venus of a little bit of its energy to speed up the spacecraft and get it closer and closer to the sun. So it's not only a feat in actually looking at the sun and understanding it, but a feat in astro-engineering or astro-steering. And we'll see how well they do in the years ahead.
Speaking about how well we'll do in the years ahead, are we going to see a space force here? I mean, it's curious because certainly President Trump and Vice President Pence are strongly behind this. It would be another military force, basically. And There's been a great deal of resistance. James Mattis at first was opposed to it, the Secretary of Defense. Now he's on board. One has to wonder what is behind that shift and so forth. But what do you make of this?
Well, this is a complicated issue. I'm not a politician, so I can't make the comments I want to make, which is that this is all saber-rattling to draw
attention of saber-rattling.
Yeah, that's right, to draw attention from other things going on in Washington. But from a science point of view, it's fascinating that this is the 50th anniversary of the Outer Space Treaty. And, Michael, this is what's really, I think, been the great agreement among nations to take advantage of space peacefully. We, in 1967, passed a treaty that said no one can own things in outer space. You can't go to the moon and claim real estate.
There can't be a Trump Tower on the moon?
There cannot. Well, there could be a Trump Tower, but the entire world has to agree. Let's see if that happens. But in fact, we can't put nuclear weapons up there. We can't militarize space. And all the countries, including the United States, that are doing space have agreed to this. So the question is, would a space force violate the Outer Space Treaty? And right now, commentators are saying no, because there is no detailed provision that says you can't do military exercises in space. You just can't have drastic weapons being used in space. And all countries use space. I mean, we have secret satellites that go up all the time to observe the world below. We have many satellites that give us the global positioning system. And many listeners probably don't know that there are two systems. There's a civilian system of global positioning, which helps your phone or your car to know where you are, but there's an even more accurate military global positioning system, which allows the military to pinpoint things on the surface of the Earth. So that's going on all the time. Whether a space force would then lead to further problems where countries could attack each other and destabilize each other's systems of satellites, this is a very scary idea. It was much more comfortable when space, everyone agreed, should be used for peaceful purposes.
Yeah, a lot of commentators
only
are calling it a half-baked idea.
Yeah,
it's a good way to describe it. We're talking to Andy Fracknoy, who is professor of astronomy at San Francisco State's Osher Learning Center, Lifelong Learning Institute, and at the University of San Francisco's Fromm Institute. He's also emeritus chair of the astronomy program at Foothill College. And you are welcome to join us with any questions that you have in the astronomical realm or any comments you have. Andy didn't want to be political, but you might want to be. And we do want to hear from you. Our toll-free number, again, is 866-733-6786. You can join us now. You can also join by emailing forum@kqed.org or going to our website, kqed.org/forum. And you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. I want to touch on a couple other things with you, because let's talk about Mars. I mean, last month and this month, it's closer to the Earth in terms of light and so forth than it's been in a long time. And now we're talking about covering the face of Mars, that famous face of Mars that a lot of people thought was actually created by someone. But water's been discovered. A lake has been discovered.
Well, that's right. So let's separate those two things. First of all, Mars is close, and it's a bright planet in the evening sky. But the problem is that every once in a while, the weather on Mars gets really crazy. And we're in one of those moments where there is a global dust storm. So dust storms, you know, if you've been to the desert and you get one of these sand or dust storms, it can be a terrible thing. Well, Mars has dust storms that get as big as the entire planet Mars. And that's what's going on right now. So it's very frustrating to amateur astronomers. Here's Mars a little bit closer, easier to see in our telescopes. And when you actually look at it, you can't see any detail because this dust storm is covering the entire face of it. But our probes around Mars are still able to do a lot of interesting things, even during the storm. And one of the most amazing pieces of work that's been done...
Aren't those robots having problem getting through some of that dust?
Yeah, they can't see visually, but they can do radar, for example, just like radar gets through fog at San Francisco Airport. And a piece of radar work done for over 4 years has pinpointed near the southern pole of Mars a region below the ice, right where the rock meets the ice, where there might be a lake, an underground lake, something like 12 miles wide, inside Mars.
Which means there could have been life, or microscopic or otherwise, of some kind.
Well, that's exactly right. So there's a parallel to this on Earth. Under the Antarctic ice, we find that there are lakes deep, deep underground where it's warm enough for microorganisms, bacteria, and small critters to survive. And we've actually drilled down into some of these lakes and actually found life underneath the ice of the Antarctic and the Arctic. Now, on Mars, it's even colder, but people are wondering whether, if there is a liquid lake, because it's still not totally certain, could some kind of life that formed on Mars, where Mars was much nicer in terms of weather than it is today, much warmer, could life have formed on Mars, and could that life still be surviving in that lake? A very fascinating prospect to explore in the future.
Well, let's explore what our listeners would like to explore. And again, you're welcome to join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. I want to also talk to you about, time permitting, new moon discovered on Jupiter. Jupiter leading the pack in moons. But let's go to our callers, and let's begin, Mike, with you. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hey, Andy. This is Mike Dickles. I haven't talked to you in decades. I wanted to thank you for dragging me to Hawaii 27 years ago for the solar eclipse, and then telling me I'd better go to Oregon 26 years later. So last year I did. So I wanted to thank you for that.
You bet.
That was wonderful. Of course, Pinatubo had just erupted the last time we went and looked at eclipses, and so the sky was kind of full of ash, but the shadows were better this time. So I wanted to thank you.
You bet. I think a lot of our listeners got to see the eclipse last year. It was probably the most viewed eclipse in the history of eclipses on Earth.
Thank you for the call. Mike, good to hear from you. We'll hear from another caller right away here, and that's Ken in Richmond. Ken, join us.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I was asking, I heard on a previous program there's another universe behind that great wall of quasars, and I was wondering if you can elaborate on that, if you know about it.
Well, so this is an interesting story. So there,
great wall of quasars?
Great wall of galaxies is what we really call it. So we're finding now, this is, again, very exciting that we're capable of doing this. We've been looking at the overall organization of the universe. We know that stars are organized into giant groups called galaxies. We now know that these galaxies, these huge islands of stars, are organized into clusters of galaxies. We now know that these clusters are organized into superclusters of galaxies. Is there an even greater organization than that? Never before have we been capable of even beginning to approach this question. But now with modern telescopes, we can look out and measure a three-dimensional map of what's out there.
But who's the head of the organization? That's what people really want to know.
Right. So we've been finding that there are great filaments or walls of galaxies with voids between them. In fact, the universe looks a little bit like Swiss cheese. And why that is and how we get this large-scale organization are still mysteries. But I think that's what our caller wanted to know about. We found some of these walls of the voids.
And I mentioned, let me thank the caller, Ken, moons on Jupiter, because 12 new moons on Jupiter recently discovered. That brings the total up to 79. And we're getting into a serious traffic problem here.
Indeed. So this is a great story, too. Scott Shepard, who's the world record holder in moon discoveries, there is such a thing in astronomy, announced that he'd found 10 new moons, and he'd found two earlier. So we have 12 new moons around Jupiter. And those are tiny moons. They're not moons that you would bring home to mom with pride, like the big moons of Jupiter. And these tiny moons, for the most part, go around the same way. The inner moons go around one way, forward. The outer moons, which are captured, go around backward. Well, one of these new moons goes against the traffic. This new moon somehow seems to be going in the opposite direction from all the moons in its neighborhood. We're calling it provisionally Valetudo, who was a great-granddaughter of Jupiter in mythology. And Valetudo, a tiny moon, is going the wrong way. And we haven't found a moon around Jupiter or anywhere else that's defying the traffic pattern in its neighborhood. So we're fascinated how that happened. Maybe some kind of accident in the past.
Well, I'm always fascinated by how deeply and profoundly fascinated with astronomy Andy Fracknoy is. He has great passion for it, and I know there are many of you who feel the same way. And if you want to join us in the time remaining, you can do so at our toll-free number, 866 833-6786 if you have questions or comments, or email us forum at kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us, or Twitter handles at KQED Forum. Here's a tweet from Charles, who wants to know, when will NASA launch a mission to send a submarine into the ocean below the ice of Europa?
Ah, yes. This is something both scientists and science fiction fans really want to find out about. So to fill everyone in, there is one moon around Jupiter called Europa. And maybe it's not the only moon that does this, but the best known moon around Jupiter, which has an underground ocean, not just a lake like we were talking about on Mars, but we think an actual underground ocean where the ice ends and the rocky parts begin. There may be an ocean several miles deep. And the question, if we want to explore that ocean again, is that could that be a place where life began, where heat from underneath warmed the ocean enough that it might have been a site for the origin of life? And so NASA would love to dig into the ice and then send something down there to see what's under the ice, what's in the ocean. It looked for a while like that was going to be really challenging because the ice could be miles and miles thick. And we have trouble digging that far even on Earth. How could we do that on a moon of Jupiter's? But now it looks like we're getting great plumes of ocean material flying out of Europa. We've measured several plumes coming out. So there might be gaps in the ice. There might be cliffs going down into the ocean where digging might be a lot easier. So having a new reconnaissance of Europa, figuring out where the openings might be to this ocean, and then getting some digging equipment there is the dream that many of us have for the future of the Jupiter system exploration.
Well, you mentioned science fiction, and often whenever talking about matters astronomical, it comes up that science fiction can be prescient and can even be oracular or forecasting what's up ahead. And there's a science fiction, might as well get this plug in, first time coming out to the Bay Area in a long time in San Jose, a science fiction convention. You're giving a couple talks.
That's right.
And I was intrigued by the titles of your talks.
So this is the World Science Fiction Convention. I am a science fiction fan from way back, Michael. I read science fiction before I ever thought of being an astronomer. It was my inspiration.
I should tell you, we literary guys somehow, there used to be kind of a snobbery about science fiction. I've overcome that. There's science fiction that really has lasted and endured for good reasons. It's really, really highly literate and damn good.
I appreciate that. So every year, the fans of science fiction get together and somewhere hold a World Science Fiction Convention. That's where the Hugo Awards for the best science fiction are given. And I've read about this all my life. And this time, as you say, it's coming to San Jose this week from August 16th to 20th. And I get to go. Not only do I get to go, but I get to give talks at the World Science Fiction Convention. So you can tell I'm tickled by this prospect. They're going to be at the San Jose Convention Center from the 16th of August to the 20th. It's called WorldCon 76. If people want to Google it, just Google WorldCon 76. And the titles of my talks, since you kindly mentioned it, my one talk is Where Will Bill Gates's Great-Granddaughter Go for Her Honeymoon? The Top Tourist Sites of the Solar System. And my other talk will be Why Pluto Was Kicked Out of the Planet Club and What We're Learning About It Today.
Well, we did a whole hour on the Pluto question, but Bill Gates' granddaughter may be one of the few to be able to afford the cost of transportation. Tell us a little more about what you're conceiving in that.
Well, so this is imagining the future when very rich people, perhaps, will be able to go and travel to the planets and the moons in our solar system that we've been talking about. So I put together my list of the top 10 future tourist sites that tourists are going to have to go to if they don't want to be ashamed when they come home. And among these is the giant volcano on Mars called Mount Olympus, which is bigger at its base than the entire state of Arizona and three times the height of Mount Everest. I think that's going to define macho in the future. If you haven't climbed Mount Olympus on Mars, you're just not an explorer. And there's a moon of Uranus's that has the deepest cliff. It's called the Verona Cliffs on Miranda, about 12 miles high, we think. But the gravity is so low a 200-pound man would only weigh a few pounds. So this is the best lover's leap in the solar system. If you leap off this cliff, you're going to travel slowly. You'll have 10 to 12 minutes to talk to your beloved, say goodbye, and prepare for your doom.
And get down to a great weight.
Yeah, that's right.
Let me bring another caller in here. And that's Dominique. Dominique, welcome.
Oh, hi, guys. I was just wondering, so the mainstream hypothesis for the sun is that it's a big ball of gas. There's some other scientists out there that think that maybe there's a solid component, like maybe like a metallic hydrogen. What do you think?
I think that's mixing up two different worlds. There is this idea that hydrogen, the most common element in the universe, under a lot of pressure, can turn into a metal, essentially conduct electricity, behave in many ways like a liquid, but a metal. This is a weird state, and it does exist. It exists inside Jupiter. That's why Jupiter is so highly magnetic and a strange world. But the sun is really hot, so there's no part of the sun that behaves like a solid. What we're investigating, though, is something very similar, which is that there is an electrical conduction inside the sun, which makes the sun a very large magnet. And it's this powerful magnet that gets all the energy into moving things away from the sun. That's what the Parker probe is going to be investigating.
I was asking you before about what we might learn from the Parker probe. And as I understand it, also will be maybe a deeper understanding of the physics of stars and certainly a great deal more about how to predict space weather. And there are a few other things. I think solar winds, you know, mm-hmm. which have become kind of a central part of this probe, haven't they?
Absolutely. So everything you say is quite right. The sun is our closest example of a star. Just to be sure that all our listeners understand, all the stars, if you were up close to them, would be like the sun. They would be giant balls of hot gas shining under their own power. And so this is our one opportunity to study a star up close. And we want to learn how stars work for all parts of astronomy. So there's the quiet sun, what it's doing inside, making energy, a reliable source of energy for billions and billions of years. And then there's the outer sun, which is full of so much extra magnetic energy that, as you say, a whole wind comes out of it. Great blasts of material and energy come out of it when we have a solar flare. So understanding that, which causes the weather in space, the sun's exposures, that's a very important part of the solar.
Well, it would presumably help with astronauts. It would help with airline flights. It would help with satellites. I mean, that whole
right.
range.
So we know that when the sun has one of these giant emissions of particles, those eventually arrive at the Earth, and they interfere with the working of satellites like the global positioning system. They can actually make the power grid do funny things. This happened years ago that all the garage doors in a part of Canada started opening and closing, opening and closing on their own because there was a tremendous surge in the power grid because of an explosion on the sun. So we really want to make sure we understand how the sun's explosive, unpredictable part works so we can be prepared on Earth for what the sun is doing when it's badly behaved.
Listener asks, has the quandary over the essence of light been resolved? Is it a particle or is it a wave?
And the answer is yes. This is the quandary that you refer to, that sometimes light acts like a particle, sometimes light acts like a wave. It has in its nature both these properties. And this is an incredible mystery because particles and waves are sort of opposite to each other. This is the quantum understanding of light. And we're now pretty resigned that this is the right way to understand both the nature of light and the nature of particles, that they behave in a quantum sort of way.
Here's Joseph who says, you want to stay away from politics, but somehow they always come back to that. Joseph says, is your guest suggesting that the U.S. should not take defensive and offensive measures to protect our interests in space, just as the Air Force does this better than the old Army Air Corps did? Wouldn't a dedicated space force perform this important task even better?
Well, this is not my field of expertise, but I will say that the people I've talked to about this say that the Air Force is already doing a pretty good job, that to create a new bureaucracy when there is not that much for them to do may just be a waste of public money. But again, there may well be reasons why in the future we may want to segregate out the space activities of the armed services into some sort of separate body. I would just say that this is not the administration I would like to see doing that. This is the most anti-science, anti-fact administration I think we've had in history. And so scientists are a little bit nervous that the science that so that is done, that the engineering and the good for the world kind of things that are done in space will somehow get short shrift if you militarize what's happening.
Talking with Andrew Fracknoy, professor of astronomy at the Osher Learning Institute of San Francisco State and University of San Francisco's Fromm Institute. You want to say something about some of these images that are coming back, the first images that have taken of a newly forming planet?
Well, so this is also exciting. We, as we've discussed on your show, and as many people perhaps know, this is the era of planets in astronomy. We've been discovering thousands of planets orbiting other stars. But what we haven't seen a picture of is a planet being born. We see stars being born, but we haven't been able to see a planet being born. And now, using the largest telescope in the world and a special instrument called SPHERE, we have actually taken a picture of a baby planet, a planet just coming out of a great cloud surrounding a newly born star. There's a kind of disk or donut of material, and in that donut we see a newly born planet for the first time. So this is something which is just very romantic, that, you know, you want to see the baby as soon as possible, and here are baby pictures of a planet revealed for the first time.
Come out with squalling or anything along those lines?
Well,
is there
a
stork involved?
In a way it is, because the dust and dirt is still around it. So you kind of see this thing still part of the womb, still part of the material of the birth, but trying to free itself and be an independent body in space.
And maybe a good final question to ask you from a listener: what's the best astronomical observatory in the Bay Area for clear views of the skies?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I just, as it happens, gave a talk at Lick Observatory. The Lick Observatory, they're sold out for this year, but the Lick Observatory has summer programs where you not only get to hear astronomers like me, but you also get to look through the telescopes at this that this great observatory has had since 1888. So if you can get tickets next year to the summer program at Lick Observatory, that's great. For everyday viewing, there's nothing that beats the Chabot Observatory in Oakland. The Chabot Science Center is one of the great public education institutions here.
And you are a great public educator, and thank you so much. Always good to have you here and to see you, Andy Fracknoy. And we are going to have another hour of Forum up ahead. We're going to meet Sarah McBride in the hour up ahead, who is a transgender woman and a leader, really, in the transgender movement. Stay tuned for that. She has her story to tell. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of the Minetti Schremm Museum of Art at UC Davis, who believe that all people deserve access to education and culture to enrich a lifetime of exploration and learning.